Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the thrice weekly Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thank you for queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy the show today. This story was first published on December 27th of 2010, under the headline, Caught Rescuing Shipwrecked Sailors, Rum Runners Sent to Prison Anyway. Captain Robert Pamphlet and his crew were sailing south in a heavy sea when they heard the distress calls. The 579-ton steam schooner Caoba, slugging it out with the gale off the mouth of the Columbia, had suffered a knockout blow. A wave had burst through and flooded the engine room, putting out the boiler fire. The ship was adrift and filling with seawater. The crew had taken to the lifeboats. Pamphlet was in perfect position to help, but there was just one problem. The hold of Pamphlet's 90-foot, 100-ton schooner, the Peskawa, was crammed with Scotch whiskey, and it was February 1st, 1925. Prohibition wouldn't end for another 8 years. Pamphlet and his crew were Canadian rum runners. At the time, this was a going business with big rewards and bigger risks. Typically, cargo ships would leave British Columbia with a hold full of cheap liquor and head south, being careful to stay in the international waters 12 miles off the U.S. shore. Then, when they reached a prearranged rendezvous spot, they'd slip inside the 12-mile line under cover of darkness, unload the cargo into waiting trucks, and race back west to the safety of the open sea, and then north to start the process all over again. That was the usual system. The Operation Pamphlet was most likely participating in was one of the more frustrating ones for Oregon law enforcement. It was an ongoing operation in which gallons and gallons of high-quality liquor were slipping up the Columbia River to supply the finer speakeasies of Portland and other large West Coast towns. The Canadian cargo ships would come down and rendezvous off the mouth of the Columbia with high-powered motor launches, taking care to remain at least 12 miles offshore in international waters. The launches would be loaded with cases of liquor. Then they would, under cover of darkness, slip across the bar and race upriver to rendezvous points on Sovie Island. Then they'd unload and do it again. These launches were like the cigarette boats of the day. Nothing the Coast Guard had could actually catch up with them. So this was a pretty successful operation, and also a somewhat flagrant one. Well, when it worked out, the job of rum running was great. But if the Peskawa were caught within that 12-mile boundary, Pamphlet and his crew would likely be sent to an American prison. So he was listening carefully to the radio to see if the crew of the Caoba were getting rescued, hoping he wouldn't have to get involved. What he was hearing was at first reassuring. The tugboat John Cudahy had found and picked up a lifeboat with 9 men in it. But Pamphlet knew a freighter the size of the Caoba would have more than 9 men on her crew. There had to be another lifeboat out there somewhere. Nobody else seemed to think so, though. Responding to the distress call, two other freighters had come to the Caoba's aid. One after the next, they tried diligently to get towing hawsers on the wallowing ship, ignoring the need to rescue her crew. Apparently by this time, it had become obvious, because of the flotation of the lumber in its hold, that the Caoba was not going to sink after all. Now, crewless and adrift, ship and cargo belonged to whoever could get a line on her, under the law of salvage rights. So first, the Forest King, and then the Thomas P. Beale came alongside and tried to take the stricken ship in tow. Then, having failed, they just went on their way. From Pamphlet's wheelhouse, it sounded like the scramble for those salvage rights was at the top of everyone's list, and the sailors on the second lifeboat, somewhere out there being tossed around in a gale if they hadn't already overturned and drowned, well, they could just look out for themselves. Pamphlet got out his map and plotted wind direction and currents. Based on where the Caoba was abandoned, as best he could know in those pre-Loran days, he figured out the patch of ocean in which the boat was most likely to be found. Then he gave the order to fall off the wind and sail due east. Eyes wide open, the Peskawa plunged into the 12-mile danger zone. After a search, the Canadians found the lifeboat, right where Pamphlet had figured it would be, and rescued its occupants. Sources differ on how many there were, 7 or 9. They included, apparently, the captain of the Caoba. And the storm had apparently subsided by this time. So leaving the empty lifeboat, the Peskawa turned west, and under full canvas hauled close to the southwest wind, started for the open sea just as fast as she could go. It wasn't fast enough. the 1,181-ton 16-knot Coast Guard cutter Algonquin, which had also plotted the winds and currents to search for survivors, got to the scene a short time later and saw a sinister-looking black schooner, canvas virtually bursting as she raced westward, and it was all over for the Piscawa. Back to Astoria the schooner went at the heels of the Algonquin with a prize crew aboard and Pamphlet and his men under arrest. When they arrived at Astoria, they were greeted by a cheering crowd, including the Caoba's entire crew. After all, it was only with a good bit of luck that the Piscawa found the tiny lifeboat bobbing in the sea. If Pamphlet and his men had stayed in safe waters, the Coast Guard cutter's chances of catching a similar lucky break and spotting them were not particularly high, and half of them, and their captain included, might very well be dead. The popular show of support may have been gratifying, but it did not help the Canadians' cause. The cheering infuriated the district immigration officer, who responded by jailing the Piscawa's crew and throwing everything he had at the men, including a charge of entering port without inspection and failure to carry the proper entry visa. This, of course, was somewhat ironic since the men had entered the port under arrest. In response, calls for clemency came from all over the U.S. and Canada. The Canadians had put themselves in jeopardy to save those sailors after two big freighters turned their backs on them in an unlovely scramble for booty. It didn't seem right to most folks that the only people on the water that day who did the right thing should pay for their heroism with prison sentences. Furthermore, there was reason to suspect that the Piscawa had made it into international waters and that the Coast Guard cutter had made the arrest outside its jurisdiction. It wasn't enough. To prison they went. The rum runner's only statement after they were sentenced, as reported by Marshall in his book, was, "Don't feel bad, mates. We did it, and we'd do it again to save a seaman's life." As for the Caoba, the lumber schooner for whose crew members the Piscawa's crew risked and gave all, well, all the salvage attempts failed. The strong southwest wind blew her up onto the coast of Washington, and she fetched up near Ocean Park. Today you can still find the ship's rusty boiler if you know where along the shore to look for it. As for Pamphlet, he died at age 59 in 1932, just a few years after his release from prison. Though a solid, healthy specimen at the time of his capture, he caught tuberculosis in the hoosegow, and it killed him. The Piscawa came to a bad end as well. After about a decade of weathering at a dock in Portland, she was sold to an Oregon City man named Victor Riley. Riley planned to use the Piscawa to sail to the Arctic and hunt whales. He recruited a crew of college students to help him and replaced the Piscawa's sturdy 100-horsepower Union power plant with a 4-cylinder automobile engine scavenged from an old Maxwell. I haven't been able to learn for sure why they did this, but it was most likely because the marine engine had been sitting so long. Chances are it needed to be rebuilt before it would run, and then, as now, a good rebuild job cost a lot more than a used auto engine lugged home from the local wrecking yard. Maxwell made its last car in 1925, so the engine was at least 8 years old when Riley and company fired it up and pointed the Piscawa at the open sea in late February 1933. The junkyard engine was simply not up to the task of muscling a 90-foot schooner around. On its way across the bar, at the moment it was needed most, the old flivver motor quit and the storied old sailing ship was washed up onto the North Jetty. Captain Riley was killed in the crash, crushed against the rocks while trying to launch the lifeboat. The other crew members managed to swim to shore. Key sources in this story include works by Don Marshall, The American Mercury, and MaritimeQuest.com. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do. Visuals that go with today's show can be found at offbeatoregon.com, where you will also find full citations to the sources for this story. The podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Got an idea for a show I should do or just want to say hi? Drop me a line at fj@offbeatoregon.com or ping me on Twitter at @offbeatoregon or send a message through the Facebook page at facebook.com/oregon.1859. Also, do let me know if you're ever going to be in Corvallis with time for a cup of coffee or a pint of Hammerhead and an inclination to talk about Oregon history. Fresh episodes of Offbeat Oregon History come your way around 6 a.m. every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. So if you're looking forward to the next one, well, you haven't got long to wait. Until then, go fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.